Welcome to the Society for Academic Emergency Medicine's Research Learning Series podcast, which focuses on helping you become a STAR research scholar. And I'm Michelle Lin from Academic Life in Emergency Medicine and UC San Francisco, your host for today. Today's episode is on how to be a good research mentor and mentee. And actually, we feature two amazing mentors for you today. You're in for a treat. We have Dr. Michael Gottlieb, the Director of Emergency Ultrasound at Rush University and COO of the Allium Faculty Incubator. We also have Dr. Corita Grudson, the Vice Chair of Research in the Department of Emergency Medicine at NYU. So let's just kick things off right now. Take it away, Mike.
Honored to be able to speak here today. I'd like to begin by talking about Dan. Now, Dan is a new faculty member. He just joined the University Medical Center about 6 months ago. He loves his job, and when he signed on, his chair said, "Ooh, I have some great projects for you." So Dan gets a couple of projects. And while he's there, there's a couple of committees, and so Dan gets appointed to some committees. And now Dan's there on these projects, on these committees, working clinically, and he's 6 months in, he's already feeling burnt out. He feels like he's working almost nonstop. He's working clinically, he has all these committees and projects, and yet he has no clinical buy-down, and he feels like he's just not supported. All of his research projects and ideas he came in there with, he hasn't even been able to get off the ground because he's so busy. And I don't think that's a unique scenario to many of us. A lot of us struggle with this early in our careers or know someone else who has. Because when you come into a new institution, how do you know what is the right course of action? How do you learn the institutional culture? How do you get promoted and clinical support and buy-down? How do you get your projects off the ground? And so the focus today is going to be on mentorship and really how to be successful at this. We're going to talk today about the importance in general, why mentorship is valuable, some of the key features on being a successful mentee, as well as being an effective mentor based on both clinical experience as well as our reviews of the literature. And finally, how this can apply in the modern digital era, how we can leverage the digital availability of technology to utilize mentorship even more effectively.
That's a great overview, and I cannot wait to hear what knowledge bombs you guys are both going to drop. So let's start this off. What might help the listeners is, what does mentorship mean to you? Is this different, for instance, from sponsorship or coaching?
Now, this can be an area of confusion for a lot of people, as there's things like coaching and sponsorship that share some similarities, but is a very distinct entity overall from mentorship. Now, coaching is typically targeted towards a specific task or skill set. So, for example, if I have challenging, difficulties with delegating tasks, I can't delegate well, I might go through some coaching to become more effective at this. And they might focus on what areas of delegation I struggle with, why I'm struggling, are there hidden competing commitments or challenges that are preventing me from being a good delegator? What are some strategies to be more effective at this? And we'll focus on this task and we'll meet several times and we'll become better at it. But it's short-term in nature. You're working on a task or a skill set, and once you attain it, you're done. That's why typically coaching sessions can range from 1 month to 6 months, maybe up to a year, but they have a set outcome. I want to be good at a specific task, a specific skill set. Then we have sponsorship. Now again, this is a more short-term, just like coaching outcome. I say, okay, I want to get promoted from assistant to associate professor, from associate to full professor. Or maybe I want to apply for a grant, and I have this person who's going to sponsor me and help me along the way. And there will be components of they're going to coach you through some of the processes. They might mentor you through some of the challenges. But overall, you have a short outcome. You say, I want to become a professor. I want to get this grant. Here's my outcome. When I meet it, it's done. Now, mentorship differs because it's more relationship focused. Rather than a specific outcome, whether it be a task or skill or a specific goal of becoming promoted to a certain level or getting a grant, your focus is on the person, on becoming a better you, on becoming a better, more effective you. And it's a long-term relationship. It's not meant to be I meet this goal at 1 month, 6 months, a year. This is meant to be a lifelong kind of relationship. There's some reciprocality involved as well. The focus here being on a lot of times you may switch roles. There may be times that you're going to work between mentor and mentee and you may be able to offer each other advice. So it's a little bit different of a structure. And while we typically think of the mentor or mentee being at a specific level, we say, okay, I envision the mentee, and I typically envision the mentee being a resident or a student or a junior faculty member, and I imagine the mentor being a senior faculty member who's been there as full professor for 10 years. But in reality, it's a lot more gray. As a junior faculty member, you can be a great mentor to your colleagues, to a student, to a resident. You have that ability to be a mentor, so it can be valuable there. But as a senior, a clinician, you've been a full professor for 10 years, we're all lifelong learners, and we're always trying to improve ourselves. And by that regard, even as you're becoming really established in your career, you still benefit from mentorship because there's areas that we can all improve on. Just like we're always learning clinically, we always are learning as people as well.
Well said, Mike. Getting mentorship and professional growth is a continuum no matter how junior or senior you are. So now let's switch gears, flip the script a little, and talk about now from the perspective of a mentor. You know, one question that I hear a lot from fellow faculty is, I'm sure busy, why again would I want to become a mentor? Clarita, got any thoughts on this?
The best thing about being a mentor is really helping others and promoting others' careers. That's the most exciting, the best thing, the best parts of my day are meeting with students, meeting with residents, and mentoring junior faculty. So aside from that, that is definitely the highlight, I think, of every career in academics. Promotion and retention is really important too. And so as you move along, even when you're a resident, you have to start documenting everything you're doing. So that can be challenging if you do a lot of different things and if you don't have a lot of help. But basically, as you move along, you want to keep track of all your mentees and keep track of where they are now. And this is things you would want to be doing anyway. Find out what people are up to, because you learn from what other people are doing. And sometimes you might actually, they will surpass you, which happens not uncommonly, and you'll be looking to them for a job at some point. You never know. Every student becomes a resident for the most part, and every resident becomes an attending. And so, you know, just because someone's in a lower role doesn't mean that they aren't going to have huge influence over you at a later date. And so you want to keep track of who all those people are in it, just basically an Excel document, how you mentored them, in what respect were you their research mentor in residency? Did you have a grant funded to do research, mentorship? For example, we have a summer institute on aging, and so I have had a lot of mentees through that. And then you want to know, what are they doing now? And that's something that's required if you're going to end up in academic medicine for promotion of yourself as a faculty member, as well as if you apply for some NIH or other funded grants, you need to document what you've done in terms of mentorship.
Oh my gosh, where were you so many years ago when I learned this way super late? Indeed, mentorship is a core component for promotion, so if you're an academic faculty member, a spreadsheet is definitely the way to go. So what are the benefits of mentorship are there from the mentor perspective?
Productivity. You know, as you move along in your career, you probably, many people at student resident level thus far probably can't relate to this as much, but papers become less important, not in the sense that you don't have to do them, you still have to do them, but you don't care as much about being the first author. Your role is really to make sure your team remains funded if you have a funded research career, and to write grants. And so you really can give those opportunities to others, and it helps you be more productive because you've really learned everything you can about how to write a manuscript, and the next step is teaching others how to do it. So that's an exciting time, because it really, what I've seen is for a resident or a student, having a publication is a huge deal in terms of helping them move their career along, and also for junior faculty. So that's something that if anyone can kind of do that for me, and it's been a part of the project, that's hugely helpful to me and hugely helpful to them to progress their own careers. And I've done plenty of that, so no learning there, much more learning with how to submit papers at this point. And then wellness, I think this is what I mentioned before. I'd say wellness is really the number one reason. The best hands down part of my day is meeting with medical students about research, even meeting with our pre-medical students, our post-bac students. I think the love of medicine, the desire to help others, we get really bitter and jaded as we go along. And so it's just very refreshing for me to meet with younger people who have not experienced that yet. And to I get as much out of meeting with them as I hope they do for me, because it's always really invigorating. People that still want to change the world, which I do too, but get a little beaten down as you go along. So that's been really nice. So that's the best part of my day and why I'm in academics. Otherwise, why would I be here if I don't want to help other people's careers?
Okay, so we're sold on the idea that mentors are a must. How would you go about finding your perfect mentor or mentors?
Some of us think, at least I did initially, very local about our mentors. You want to think much more broad. If you have something, if you're one of these people that knows exactly what your passion is and your interest within academic medicine or medicine in general, and you know, for example, like myself, I do palliative care research. There's only a handful of people in the country that do funded palliative care work that are available as mentors. And so I basically reach out to every single one and like beg and plead with them to have a phone conversation with me or to meet with me at a meeting. And if you're in a field, you know, I would think way beyond just emergency medicine, having mentors who are not only within your specialty, but physicians outside your specialty is key. So most of my mentors have been internists or critical care, or, you know, I've had emergency medicine mentors too. And then thinking about PhDs, so I had a sociologist as a mentor, I've had patients. So if you're looking at patient-oriented research, having patient representatives and other stakeholders, administrators, who maybe someone like Melissa, who's running this show for us.
Side note. Melissa McMillian is SAEM's star director of foundation and business development.
We've worked together. She's been a mentor to me as well in terms of understanding when I ran the consensus conference and a partner and all those things. So, and we brought a number of patient representatives to our consensus conference. So I think those are other things to think about. You're going to get different things from many different people. So that's key, is to really just have a huge kitchen cabinet, so to speak, of mentors.
Let's keep this interesting and ping pong this away from the mentor perspective and back to the mentee perspective. I'm going to kick it back to you again, Mike. Help the potential future mentees get into the right mindset.
One of the most valuable components is preparation. And I'm going to split preparation into two components. The first is the classic sense of preparation, meaning you show up on time, you schedule a meeting in advance, you have your CV ready, your academic portfolio, have everything ready. Have some topics for discussion because everyone's really busy and you want to be effective and efficient with your time. You want to really maximize the time you have with this mentor. The other aspect I think we sometimes take for granted is the introspective aspect. So before you meet with them, just take a few minutes and think about where you are, where you want to be. What type of doctor do you want to be? What type of clinician, academician, researcher you want to be? Where do you see yourself in 5, 10, 15 years? And how can the mentor get you there? So when you're meeting with them, you're having a much deeper type of conversation than just, yeah, I'd like to become a speaker. And you can think about this going back to in the beginning, we talked about coaching versus sponsorship versus mentorship. I can go into a meeting and say, I'd like to become a better speaker. Okay, great. We can go through some coaching on that. That's a short-term outcome. And at a certain point, that's done. Or I'd really like to speak at SAM. Great. That's a sponsorship outcome, right? That's a specific project I want to be a part of. And when I get that spot, it's done. But push beyond there and become, I want to be the best speaker. You know, how do I become the best speaker? How do I manage this from a work-life balance standpoint with all the traveling? How do I get involved with different circles? How do I maintain these speaking opportunities? How do I, you know, make things count twice so I'm not duplicating efforts? The deeper level of that, all the components involved in that, you'll have a much more fruitful meeting. And then you have things that you can work on between that and the next meeting. It's not just I'm waiting for an invite for a speaker. You're saying, okay, I'm going to work on this. I'm going to work on how I'm going to make things count twice. I'm going to work on how I can balance things. So just spending a few minutes thinking introspectively of where you are and where you want to be and how your mentor can help will allow you to have a much deeper and more beneficial conversation than just showing up and saying, great, I'd like to do this.
Yes, love it. It's like the Coast Guard motto says, semper paratus, always prepared, this time as a mentee before meeting your mentor. So speaking of meeting, how often do you or should you meet with your mentor? Should you stalk them on Facebook or in their driveway? Or is it a one and done? Let's talk meeting etiquette.
It's usually fairly easy to schedule that first meeting, but it becomes progressively harder to have those serial meetings in there. Part of it is setting aside the time, and we're all so busy. We're trying to balance being clinicians, working clinically, doing research projects, sitting on committees, giving national lectures, traveling to national conferences. All those things going on, and yet also somehow maintaining work-life balance. And it sometimes can be overwhelming to then have these meetings on top of it, saying, I have to meet with a mentor on top of all of this. And I would argue that's the time it's the most valuable. Because when you're really busy and we're stuck with a million things on our list, and my to-do list is running into 2 pages long, I'm just going head down, task after task after task, just trying to keep up, trying to keep my head above water as I'm trying to focus on things and get them done. And the problem is, if that's all you're doing, you don't really know which way you're going. You don't know where your direction is. And that's where the mentor can be valuable, to sit there from that mile high view and say, okay, I see you've been doing a lot of these projects here, but what's your goal of doing these series of projects? Where is it getting you? What's your end game of this? How is this helping you on the right track? Or is this actually detracting from your ability to do something that may be more time consuming, but more valuable from your career or your personal happiness? And so it can be valuable to have that mentor step in and say, here's your mile high view. Here's what you might benefit from doing. The other aspect is to make sure you're being efficient with what you're doing. We may have one way of doing it, but the mentor can be valuable in showing you a more efficient, easier way of getting a project done, or connecting you with collaborators who have shared interests. So maybe you can divert some of the effort into them. You can work together on a project instead of having to bear all the weight on your own shoulders.
So it sounds like, Mike, especially when you're busy, it's even more important to have mentor input on your focus and your direction. So how often would you suggest a person then meet with their mentor?
I would aim somewhere between weekly and every few months. Once we start to get towards these annual meetings, it becomes hard because you're so separated out. It's almost like you're just re-catching up every meeting instead of having targeted outcomes you can be working on.
Great. So far, you've mentioned that mentees should be, one, prepared, and two, meet regularly with their mentors. Any other tips?
A lot of times we envision there's one mentor, or there's two mentors, and often there will be a couple of core mentors that you go to most frequently. But if you can, really develop a network of mentors, a series of mentors that you can go to for different things. And it can be beneficial for one regard, people have different skill sets. Someone who is a great researcher might really struggle with work-life balance. So you're only going to benefit really from research questions with them. They probably wouldn't be a great resource for work-life balance. Or someone who's a great speaker might struggle with other areas of, you know, bedside teaching. And that's always going to be a challenge. So you have people you can go to for specific skill sets. And just how we're all busy, our mentors are really busy too. So they might not be able to meet with you in a couple of weeks. And if you have an important decision, it's valuable to have other mentors you can go to if your kind of primary mentors are really busy. Or if you have a really tough decision, you're really struggling with a scenario, it can actually be valuable to have multiple opinions. That's what we do in our personal lives, right? We ask more than one person, we get opinions. Same things with your career. It's valuable to have different opinions because what works for one might not work for another. If I have a research project and I'm trying to get it off the ground and I have no funding, no research assistance, no internal grants available, if I go to someone who's a phenomenal researcher who has research assistants, grant writers, copy editors, research coordinators, and tons of funding, they're not going to be a great resource for me because they're not going to understand the position I'm in. So while they may be a phenomenal mentor for research, they're the wrong choice for this environment. And same time, if you have someone that mostly does unfunded research, they're not a great person to go to about grants because they don't do them. So even within these subsets of research, you can have different mentors for different skills. So as much as possible, really develop your mentor networks. And as you progress forward, I found that my mentor network has grown exponentially as I move forward because people will introduce you to others who also share similar interests and who also have beneficial subsets of skill sets that are really valuable.
Corita, any insights or thoughts on this for mentees?
The way to be the best mentee is really to work hard and to make sure that you under-promise and over-deliver. So I don't think that can be said enough, that when you've got mentors, especially someone, if it's a funded NIH researcher, they're going to expect probably to meet with you weekly, if not daily, more than you want to at times. That's the irony, is that I think in research, we have exceedingly high expectations for the mentor-mentee relationship, sometimes that are unrealistic. They're going to expect that when you meet with them, that you have accomplished things within the last 7 days or 2 days. It speaks a lot to the wellness aspect. A lot of funded researchers don't have the best work-life balance or work-life integration. And so they're really going to expect to get updates from you. And I think the other thing is you have to expect to drive the relationship, in the sense that you need to make it clear what you want out of the relationship and not just do, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but basically that you want to set the frequency, You want to get what you need out of the meetings, and they'll expect you to drive the relationship. They'll expect you, if you have a grant due, to send them something far in advance and to get feedback on it. They'll expect you to submit a manuscript to them, and they'll go through it with track changes, and probably 20 times you'll realize you've never knew how many track changes and how many versions. People say, oh, I already made the edits. And you're like, no. That's the first time out of 40 times you will be revising this. So I think those types of things, people will expect you to really turn around manuscripts, turn around grants very quickly, and incorporate everything they're suggesting, or give a reason why not. You don't have to do everything your mentorship team or mentor says, but they're really going to have a very high expectation that you're going to detail what they recommended you do. If they said meet with someone, you need to schedule a meeting. So unless you have a real good reason why you're not doing it, you really want to follow through on everything someone is telling you, or argue about, give a reason why you're not going to do it. Because, I mean, you're not trying to be a clone of that person, but you're trying to respect their advice and at least follow through on what they're requesting.
Okay, we're going to ping pong it back to the perspective of the mentor. And I think you've both done an eloquent job convincing us that we all want to be all-star mentors. So is there any literature or guidance that we might be able to read about on how to be such a mentor?
Consistently, and there's a lot of literature published on ideal characteristics of mentors and how to be a successful mentor. And at the top of the list almost every time is accessibility. And I'm going to similarly split this into two aspects as well. Step one is just being available, right? We're so busy. Having standing meetings with your mentee, having it built into your schedule so you request a day off, you're available for them, or just having specific office hours we can have, okay, on Tuesdays, I'll be in my office, you drop by with questions, I'm available at this time. Having that be available for them, having yourself available for them as frequently as you can be, it just makes it such a more comfortable relationship. It really focuses on the person. Even emails, if you can just respond to them more frequently, is also, again, very valuable there. But the other aspect is when you're there, actually being there. What I mean is we have so many distractions. I sit in my office and the phone is ringing, my computer's giving me emails and Slack messages, and I have text messages, and I have voicemails, and I have someone knocking on the door, and we have a million distractions. It's so easy to just flip open your phone when it blinks and say, oh, what's this newest email? Okay, I'm gonna check 2 seconds. But as much as you can, avoid that temptation, and just think about it when you're working clinically. Right? You're talking to a patient, you're sitting in the room, and you're trying to get a history from them, and they're on the phone. And then you're trying to tell them what to watch out for, what return precautions are, and they're on the phone. And they're listening, and they're there, and they can repeat it back to you, but they're on their phone. And then you're really emphasizing the importance of following up with their doctor in a couple days, and they're on their phone. And while they may hear everything you're saying, how connected do you feel that person? Not at all, right? You feel like they're not listening. You feel like they're not connected. And I think a lot of us, it's so easy now, just flip over your phone, just respond to a quick text, a real quick email, the 2 seconds, I'll be right back. Just 1 second, let me just do this email, I'll be right back. And you've lost that connection. And there's nothing so urgent. There's never been an email, I think, in the history of time that's had to be answered within 20 minutes, right? If it was, they'd call you. There's no email that's so urgent. You can't just wait till you finish talking. But it really just disconnects that connection between people. And because mentorship is so relationship oriented, it could just be so harmful, such a small, trivial thing that we don't think about. So oftentimes when I'm meeting with mentees, I'll actually have my computer flipped down and my phone flipped over, put in the corner so I can't be distracted, because I'm a technology person. I have to look at my phone like 25, 30 times a day. And I set aside time like, this is not time to be looking at anything else. I'll open my computer if there's a direct thing we're working on, and I'll actually make a conscious effort to go and click past my email so I don't get distracted looking at things, because it's so easy to get distracted, but it really takes away that connection, which is such a crucial aspect of mentoring. The other thing to think about is just avoiding judgment. A lot of times, your mentee will come to you, and our mindset is, this is how I've been successful. I know what to do. It's worked really well for me. This is the absolute best way because look how well it worked for me. And that may not be the trajectory the mentee is looking at. You may have built your career on being a public speaker. You've lectured locally and nationally. Your name has all this recognition. You get invited to all the major conferences. And the first thing the mentee does when they sit in the room with you is they say, hey, just so you know, I have no interest in lecturing. And you're like, why would you say that? You came to me and I'm the lecturer. Why would you not want to talk about this? But in reality, we all have multiple skill sets. We're not one dimensional. Oftentimes, maybe it's your networking skills, your work-life balance, your ability to do unfunded research. There might be something that they're reaching out for you that you may not see as important as your primary focus, but to them, it's pretty important. And by the same token, they may not realize the importance of what you're doing. They may say, I don't want to do public speaking because it's way too much work, or I hate talking to people, or I had this one experience that was awful and I never want to do it again. And the problem here is they don't realize the value of it. So you can be a great resource to help them realize the potential value of speaking, but accept that they may not listen, and that's okay. Your job is to help them for their career, and it may take a different pathway than yours does, but as long as you're a resource there, you're doing good. Karita?
Couldn't agree more. And I think that I'm so used to people that I meet with not being interested in research that I sometimes forget some people actually are interested in research. But I think one of the things about being a mentor, and I don't think I'm there yet, is I think getting to know someone enough that you have faith in them. And I think it's reciprocal. You have faith in the mentee and the mentee has faith in you. And then it can get really interesting, because you get to this place where you can be made to feel, as a mentee and as a mentor, make someone feel very uncomfortable in a good way. I can tell you, when I did fellowship at UCLA, I had a mentor who was, you know, some people would think he was mean, or he was just out there crazy. He would make people cry, you know, but when I look back, he never made me cry, because I knew that he had faith in me. He knew we had an understanding, and he pushed me in ways that very few people have. And I think that kind of mentorship, having that faith, reciprocal faith in one another, and having someone able to really push you to think through your ideas in the research arena is so rare. But it needs to be, the relationship has to be grounded, I think, before you can get there. And that gets to kind of the teaching instead of telling. So he would never tell us, you know, this is what you should be doing. He would ask a million questions. I remember a friend of mine who was a fellow with me. She's a gastroenterologist, but I did an interdisciplinary fellowship. And she said by the end of presenting research to him, she would feel like she was not only questioning the research idea, but her own existence as a human being. So that is a good place to be. When you're questioning your entire career and why am I doing it, he would make it so real. And by the end, it would be bulletproof, whatever you were coming up with. And he would sit with you for that. I mean, he would take you through that process. And I think that's the teaching instead of telling. There are a lot of mentors who will give you a piece of what they're doing, a little snippet. Okay, go, like, I want a mini me, you know, someone that'll go. And that's really helpful. But the truly great mentors, and I am not one of these people, I hope someday to be one, but I aspire to be, but will really push you to think for yourself and come up with something, even if it's not good for my career and it doesn't help my career. And that's what, there are a few people out there like that. Bob Brook at UCLA, unfortunately, I don't know how much mentorship he's doing anymore, is one of those people who just would teach instead of telling you what to do. And it was incredible.
He sounds amazing and a little bit frightening, but mostly amazing. Agreed that there are very few out there who teach and don't tell. So if you've got one of those mentors who are gems, hold on to them. Now let's switch gears to the topic near and dear to my heart in this modern age of technology, and that is digital mentorship. Take it away, Mike.
So in the digital era, I mean, over the past decade, it's just been phenomenal how much mentorship has changed. If you look back a couple of decades prior to the internet, you're pretty much limited to your own institution. You join institutions, you either get paired up with someone or you may reach out locally, but you're pretty limited to what's available. And that can be a big limitation, because you may not have a mentor in your area of interest. If you're interested in qualitative research and there's no qualitative researcher, well, you're out of luck. Or if you just are trying to find a good mentor and you don't connect with them, or maybe you find that awesome mentor, that amazing person you connect with, they're so good that they have 7 other mentees, they may not have capacity. So sometimes you're stuck in this tough scenario where you don't have a lot of great mentorship. And the beauty is that, you know, in the current era, it's a couple of clicks away to reach someone around the world. There's no longer these geographic or time zone limitations. Any hour of the day, you can reach out to someone via Twitter, via Facebook, and connect and get insights and mentorship externally. For me personally, 2/3 of my mentors are external to my institution, and a lot of them are even external to my state and my country. You meet people all around the world and you get these mentorship opportunities. And while these are amazing opportunities to the ability of the digital era, there are some limitations to consider. Now we're going to follow, you still follow the same components of general mentorship advice, which is being prepared properly, following up, trying to develop mentorship networks. But there are some challenges unique to the digital environment, one of which is the loss of the face-to-face conversation. So if you imagine when you're emailing with someone or you're sending messages, you're texting, it's not the same as sitting down and having a face-to-face conversation. You lose that nonverbal aspect of communication that is so crucial. I recommend if you can at least get together during national conferences when everyone's in the same place, get coffee, catch up, discuss aspects of this. But you can also, again, use the digital environment to meet even if you're not in the same country. Things like Google Hangout and Skype allow that face-to-face conversation. And while you can call someone on the phone, think about what happens when we're on the phone. I'm talking to someone on the phone and I'm walking around my apartment and maybe I'm checking my email and I'm organizing some things. It's so easy to be distracted and you just don't feel the same way of connection. Versus when you're face-to-face, you're really almost forced to be cognizant and paying attention and linked in. But for that same reason, you connect with that person like a human being. You see their face, you have that connection, and it allows you to develop a deeper relationship than if you're just having emails or phone calls. The other challenge that can come up is just relying solely on digital mentorship. So while there are a lot of really amazing mentors out there, this should be a supplement. You should still try to have some local institutional mentorship. Specifically, there are going to be unique aspects of your institution that other people won't understand. So if you're trying to understand institutional culture, you're trying to get promoted or trying to get internal grants, you need to understand what the current environment is, but also you want to have someone that can support you, right? You want to have someone that when you're trying to do a difficult project, you have that support, you have that institutional buy-in. And so there's a lot of value in maintaining that local mentorship, but supplementing it with a lot of the digital aspect.
Well said, Mike. So now let's wrap things up. I have a few questions from the audience for both of you. But first, any take-home messages you want to leave for our listeners so that they can hone in on them?
Take advantage of mentorship. It's been shown time and time again to make people both personally and professionally more happy. People do better. They produce more research. They're more productive. They get promoted sooner. When you're looking for mentorship, don't just look at your own department. Look at other departments that may share similarities. Look external to your institution. Look in the surrounding cities. Look in the surrounding countries. You can reach out virtually to pretty much anyone. But also, make sure you have some local mentors.
Yeah, Rita? That's great. The other thing I would say is a lot of my mentors, the man I spoke about earlier, was the formal director of my fellowship program. So there are a lot of formal mentorship opportunities. So if you're interested in research, for example, there are opportunities through SAM, like exactly, you know, this research series. There are within your specific interest. So I am interested in palliative care.
Looks like we may have lost Karita here for a second, but I think the point she's trying to mention is the importance of formal networks. There are a number of different organizational efforts out there, national research mentoring programs and other, you know, groups within there that allow you just research to other, or access to other researchers and people who can be, serve as mentors if you don't find that you have enough local resources. I will speak briefly on her behalf and mine as well. We do want to thank SAM for the opportunity to give this webinar and all of our mentors who have been just amazing and whom, without whom our careers would not be where they are today.
Okay, now we're going to turn it over to the questions in the audience, and I've got three for you lined up. First one, I got a question from Mike. Local or virtual? Does your primary research mentor on a research grant need to be local?
That's a great question. It depends to some degree on the type of grant. I think most national grants, it just, if you have a great local mentor, that's excellent. You can also reach out virtually to people at other institutions. There's no reason you have to stay within your institution for that. However, if you're looking at more of a local grant within your institution, I'd highly recommend at least having someone who is at that institution who's gotten grants before to be a valuable resource. A lot of times we'll understand some of the idiosyncrasies of that local institution that may be challenges to that you'll face, some things that you may not consider within the institution and where the priorities are. So again, it can be valuable for local grants to really have someone on the inside who understands how it works. But for national grants, it's probably okay to reach out virtually as well.
Great answer. Question number two, are there specific things to watch out for to avoid mentorship challenges or signs of a poor mentor-mentee fit? Karita, would love your thoughts on this.
I try to avoid meeting with someone until I know what it's about. So I ask them, I think a lot of very savvy mentors do this to avoid problems down the line. Have someone send you what it is, a proposal for what they want to meet about. So for example, you know, if I get an email from a medical student that says, I want to meet to talk about research, you know, our time is really valuable and I want to know, well, about what? So if you have an idea, send me, or if you have a proposal, how much time are you willing to put into it? I'm happy to meet with anybody as long as I know what it's about and that I can be helpful.
I completely agree. And this goes back to the importance of just having a goal in mind for the meeting, having a specific set, I would like to do this and this is how I want to do it. And this is what I'm looking for on my mentor. So having a focus for the meeting definitely is extremely valuable from the mentee aspect. From the mentor aspect as well, it can be challenging, I think, sometimes to figure out before a meeting how you'll connect with the mentee. There's some people that you meet with and the initial meeting goes okay, and then you connect really well as you progress forward. And sometimes you connect with someone that's just kind of not a great mentee. They don't follow through very well. You don't feel like connected to them. You realize your goals don't quite align. If you've met with them, you committed to meeting with them, I would give them a couple meetings to see how you connect with people. Once you've kind of decided you want to start this mentee-mentor relationship, really give it a couple of meetings to see how you progress, because sometimes it's just tough to say in the first meeting where you'll be and how the mentoring relationship will progress.
And last question, is there an ideal number of mentors for you to obtain for your first research project?
So I haven't, in my review of the literature, I have not seen anything where there's an evidence-based breakdown of it. There's a lot of suggestions that if you're going to have mentors, you should at least have a research, a promotion, tenure, and a work-life mentor. That tends to be the bare minimum number of mentors to be successful in an academic career. Within research itself, it can be variable. Some of the easier projects are probably fine with one mentor, but some of the more complicated, if you haven't written a grant before, you may need more than one mentor in that. Someone that might have grant expertise, maybe someone who's content expertise. A lot of times it will vary depending upon the project and the type of mentors. Someone who is a very versatile mentor may be able to help you with the project itself and with the grant application and with how to organize large teams. Sometimes it might just be they're great for grants, but they may not be helpful for the rest, and you may need to supplement with an additional mentor.
Yeah, I would say for traditional, if you're applying, for example, for a K-23, a Mentored Career Development Award, people will expect you to have a mentor from your specialty, so emergency medicine. They'll expect you to have someone with content expertise in whatever you're studying. So if it's a cardiology project, have a cardiologist. They'll expect you to have a mentor in the methods part. So if you're doing qualitative research, you got to have a PhD who's a, you know, anthropologist or sociologist or some kind of, or a nursing PhD. If you're doing health services research, they'll expect a PhD in health services or an economist. This is kind of the by the book type things. So they'll expect multiple. What you need to get started, you don't, I'd say one is enough, you know, obviously, but the more people you can have behind you and the more you can do kind of getting, it's more just for stakeholder building. It's part because you don't know what you're doing, but also you really want to get, I can't emphasize enough how much preparation has to be done for any kind of research project. We usually think like the research starts when you enroll the first patient. That's actually the very end. I can kind of walk away once that's happening as an investigator because everything is set and my team can kind of take care of it. The preparation is really all the meetings to get buy-in that this research makes sense, that it's patient-centered, that it's the right question I'm asking, that all the stakeholders have weighed in. So I'd say the more, the better. One time we had someone that applied at NYU that got the feedback that she had too many mentors, but that is very, very rare. And that was like 20. So the more, the better in terms of at least people you can get feedback from.
I think you bring up a really interesting point as well, is that the mentorship should not be limited to just the people who are the experts in there, but having feedback from the end users as well. So if you're doing a project that's going to heavily involve nursing, there's going to be a lot of really valuable insights from the nurses on the front lines of this project. And they'll actually provide a lot of mentorship of how this may actually be applicable in real life. So again, just thinking of a mentorship beyond the classical, this is the expert in just this, you know, subset of it. But there's a lot of people who can provide some great mentorship for some of these projects.
All right, we're almost done. And actually, there is one bonus question. I totally lied to you. There's a fourth one. But as mentors, how do you manage multiple mentees at the same time?
I actually have recently done something about this. I have group mentorship meetings, and this has been life-changing for me because everyone is pretty much asking the same questions. And so I now have a lab meeting where my research staff comes, all my mentees come, everyone brings whatever they want us to look at, whether it's a paper, a grant, and we all read it and we really learn from each other. Because what I realized is I was just repeating myself all the time. And often a peer can answer a question much better than you can answer it yourself. So I'm not sure why more people don't do it. Obviously, if you need to have a confidential discussion or someone's like on the brink of like a nervous breakdown because they've got too much work or too many shifts or whatever, that's going to be a private discussion. But for the most part, I think there's a lot that can be done in groups. So that's one thing I've done that helped so much. It gave me like hours back of my life. And I think they all enjoyed it as much as the one-on-one meetings. And one of the formal mentorship programs that I was talking about when my line cut out earlier, it's called the Cambia Health Foundation. They set us up with formal mentors, and some of them do a group call rather than individual. And my mentor decided to do an individual call, which was really helpful. But I think I would have benefited also from maybe some of the group calls as well. So just a thought to save time.
So I really love that concept. There's been a little bit of research into that in the business world where they do these kind of combined groups, sometimes referred to as a mastermind group, but there's other variations of this. And the idea that people can learn from each other, and that it almost to some degree breaks down a little bit of the barrier of mentor versus mentee, because people get feedback to each other as well. So instead of having one mentor to one mentee as a straight didactic downward, it's you have all these different people who are offering feedback to each other. And you develop this small group of co-mentor, co-mentees. It's been it's efficient, as you mentioned, absolutely. But it's also just a great way of having your kind of starter version of a network of mentors and mentees. So as long as you're able to coordinate the scheduling of it, it's a phenomenal idea.
The other thing it does is that I found that it's kind of the same way that presenting a patient in front of the patient with a resident takes away all the layers of, oh, this person's unreliable. Da, da. You know, you can't, it kind of takes away all the kind of chatter that happens. And I don't mean chatter that's helpful, like chatter about getting to know someone's family and how their weekend was. That's really important. We always start with that in my lab meeting. So that's really important. But I mean the chatter about gossip and things like, you know, stuff we shouldn't be talking about. Once you're in a group setting, I found it really takes a lot of that noise away. It's kind of like presenting a patient in front of the patient. Like, you can't talk about how the patient's unreliable when they're, so you just get the story, you get the real story. So, and then you can talk later in private about, you know, that the person is, you know, you think manipulating the system and whatever, but at least you first get the story and not the background.
Well, thanks to both of you for your thoughtful reflections and insights, to Dr. Corita Grudson and Dr. Michael Gottlieb, about being a good research mentor and mentee. Gosh, there was so much to digest in there, but in brief, here's what I distilled as core takeaway points. For the mentee, three items. One, get yourself a network of mentors, with each to address specific needs that you have, such as grant writing, bedside teaching, or speaking skills. Number two, be the driver in the mentor-mentee relationship by being prepared and laser-focused on deliverables. And number three, your best fit mentors may be local, but they also may be elsewhere virtually. For the mentor, I also have three takeaways. One, pay it forward. Get inspired by helping mentees. Number two, be available and present for your mentees. And three, mentor more efficiently using and employing mentorship groups. So that's a wrap for today. Thank you for listening to the SAEM Research Learning Series. Subscribe to our Academic Life and Emergency Medicine podcast on SoundCloud or iTunes to catch our next episode. See you next time.